Owners of earthquake-prone buildings will now have a four-year extension on the deadline to strengthen or demolish. In a widely anticipated move last week, the government also announced it would bring forward a review of earthquake legislation. That will begin immediately. And in the meantime, building owners now have an extra 4 years to get their buildings up to scratch, meaning a reprieve for the owners of some 500 buildings whose existing deadlines were due to be reached over the next 4 years. Chris Penk is the Minister for Building and Construction. Thanks for your time this morning. Welcome.
Morena, good to join you. Thank you.
So this four-year extension, how will this work? Would it simply be an extra 4 years on whatever your deadline is? How does it work?
Yes, that is right. So it's a staggered approach. So for those who have got a deadline that's coming up very shortly, they'll get, you know, effectively an extra 4 years from now. And for those for whom it's a little way in the distance, let's say 5 years, then naturally add 4 years on to the end of that. But I should just be really clear, by the way, it will be 4 years from the point that the legislation is amended to say that the extension is in effect. I can't make that, you know, declaration by fiat that the law has changed at the moment, because it is in the statute, the Building Act.
Presumably, however, you have the support of your coalition partners for this. You have the numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. That's been, you know, a cabinet decision. There'd be no doubt as to that. But I just thought, as a matter of timing and thinking about Fitzgerald and Muldoon, and some of your listeners will be familiar with the care that we have to exercise in that regard.
All right. Leaves people in different situations. Let's start with the people who are stuck with properties they can't afford to strengthen and can't sell. It at least means they won't be in breach of the law. But in some ways, it just also extends the kind of purgatory, doesn't it?
Well, that is the danger, yes. And so, having heard the call for an extension and recognising that some people do need some more time, I was really keen, and the government is keen, that we don't simply kick the can down the road so that you and I are having this conversation again in 4 years' time. So I think there is one real-world consideration in this regarding the timing, which is that there's has been, until now at least, not enough labour, as in resources, to physically do the works. So to the extent that people can afford to do that but simply won't get enough people engaged in to do the physical works in the time frame, for those there will be an immediate and obvious benefit. They'll have a bit of breathing space.
Yeah. I guess the risk is, Minister, that people might even stop work they were planning to do while they wait for the review of the rules in the hopes they won't have to do it.
Yeah, well, that's certainly possible. And I mean, they would be unwise, and I would be unwise, to prejudge the outcome of the review. But I do accept that's a possibility, that people will say, oh, very well, we'll just put down tools. But there are benefits to actually moving more quickly and getting work done that might be halfway through or in the planning. One is that for the commercial buildings or those with whom there's a landlord-tenant relationship, it makes it much more tenable to be complying with the rules as they are. And of course, you know, there are private insurance arrangements that might require a certain standard separate to the legal obligation that the government imposes.
The terms of reference are out next month, but can we dig into what the review will look into? You know some of the well-traversed issues, and one obvious one is the affordability is just not there. The escape route is just not there for so many people. So what do you do about that? And another we'll come to in more detail is what is currently guiding the standards with respect to risk to life and loss of life. But let's just start with the basics. What do you anticipate the review will delve into?
Well, the review will be very much first principle. There's nothing that's off the table, I suppose, at this sense, because the terms of reference haven't been finalised. But also in the sense that this is a reaction or a response to the fact that legislation was put in place a decade ago following the tragedy of the Canterbury earthquakes. And of course, since then, we've had Kaikoura too. And at that point, it was promised that at the 10-year mark, there would be a review. So I think the moral commitment is that there would be a pretty broad look at the settings to check that they're right, to check that they're practicable and implementable. And by the way, the answer in the meantime seems to be that in a lot of cases, they're not. So in terms of what the review will be, obviously, there's an obvious question about safety of life, but also resilience, which is the performance of buildings immediately post a quake and beyond. If you're thinking about what we need following an earthquake, we need something still to be standing to coordinate the response and the recovery, if nothing else. So those things are on the table, and obviously all the practical considerations you mentioned a minute ago, such as how we get people out of the situation they're in, are in limbo. They can't get out. It's a purgatory, as you say. So we need to provide options for them either to do the work themselves or perhaps make it possible for the building to be sold and then demolished or done up by someone else who's able to do that.
A lot to work through there. First instance, heritage rules are part of this. Do you envisage they may well be in the spotlight as to whether heritage rules are preventing people who may have in good faith bought a building being able to use it or sell it? And what consideration will be given to the heritage rules, particularly in some of the smaller provincial cities, but also in the capital, which is obviously has a very large number of buildings on the list? What's your perspective?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right to highlight that heritage rules will be in the spotlight. It's inevitable because of the proportion of earthquake-prone buildings that are earthquake prone because they're old, and because they're old, they also have some sort of heritage status. And you know, we've got to be a little bit careful, I suppose. There are balances to be made between some aesthetic values, but on the other hand, we live in a world where housing supply has been constrained all these decades. So we've got to be quite clear-eyed about the challenges of maintaining heritage status in the way that some view as a luxury. And you're right, of course, to highlight the difference between provincial towns and cities such as Wellington, not least of all because actually the economic value of some of these heritage buildings to smaller town New Zealand actually is an argument in favour of retaining heritage rather than to say, as you would be more inclined to say in the likes of Wellington, well, there's a cost to it and it's frankly an impediment in people being able to do a thing to make their building safe in the way they want to, in a way they can afford to, and then to be able to, you know, live in the damn thing.
So two prospects is one is that the heritage rules are loosened and that buildings that may have heritage value go because no one can afford to repair them or upgrade them, right? A second possibility is what you mentioned there with respect to someone else taking over a property with a view to demolishing or upgrading. This was an idea that one of the Wellington City Councillors, Iona Pannett, very involved in this area, is in favour of, that there should be an encouragement of well-capitalised companies who have the wherewithal to upgrade these buildings to buy them and upgrade them. However, they're going to want a profit margin. Are you considering some kind of a scheme that may also involve the governments that might enable that, or some other process that might make that feasible for the vendors, for the sellers?
Yes, again, everything is on the table. I mean, these questions interact with resource management, local government and arts, culture and heritage in a way that I can't simply wave a magic wand myself. But I know that colleagues will be interested to know whether there are things we can do to allow exactly what you've described. And it might be, for example, that more permissive planning rules enable a building that's currently earthquake prone and frankly not much can be done with it to be demolished and something that is able to be built in its place, for example, with a lesser of a height restriction, by which I mean, you know, a higher building, I suppose, just excuse the double negative. So, I mean, that might be one possibility. Overseas persons at the moment, of course, you know, have some constraints in buying property in New Zealand. And I can only imagine, and again, this is not to prejudge the terms of the review, let alone its outcome, but I can imagine if you're sitting in a pretty desperate situation because you've got the misfortune to own an earthquake-prone apartment unit within Wellington, you don't really care if someone's offering to take that off your hands, what the passport in their back pocket says. So, I mean, again, these are policy issues to be discussed by all of government, so that's not for me to be judged, but I would say we could be a bit creative about the kinds of setting that might be available to make it attractive for people to do something.
Well, you'd be having a discussion with New Zealand First about that and perhaps putting some parameters around where that money could come and on what conditions. Let's talk about the other matter here that frustrates so many people. This is the red chapter and yellow chapter, for example, that took some buildings in the capital, again, because I'm familiar with that, from being, 80% plus of the building standard, the NBS, to less than 15%. And this affected office buildings, all sorts of buildings. The problem for many people is the rolling mall. Some people have already strengthened their apartments to be told they have to strengthen them again. How can that happen? And how can you bring some certainty to the engineering input into these rules?
Well, that is an exceptionally good question. This is part of the conundrum that we face now. We want to move in a way that enables people greater certainty, but of course by conducting a review and potentially changing the law, by its very nature, that exercise creates uncertainty in the meantime. So that's why we thought a pause of 4 years, and 4 years alone would be about the right time frame. But I do acknowledge as well that the point that underlies your question, which is the legal fiction versus the physical reality. By that I mean we might have a building that one day, you know, to all intents and purposes, is safe and not dangerous from an earthquake perspective. Then if the rules say one thing and it's judged to be, you know, a certain number of percentage on above or below a line of, say, 34%, then it's either fit or not, as the case may be. Actually, anecdotally as well, there's a problem when you've got different engineering reports might come up with a different conclusion, and therefore, you know, the risk is we're living in a fool's paradise. The rules might actually be, or the implementation of the rules might be such that some buildings are safe that are deemed to be unsafe, but actually worse than that, there might be some that are unsafe that we currently think in a fool's paradise actually are fine because I've got a piece of paper that's got a percentage sign next to it that says it's okay by the rules. So much to work through and pretty fundamental questions, including just as to the technical kind of aspects of how we measure.
It is the weakest point is assessed by that engineer that determines the rating, of course, and it was the precast concrete floors, I think, that did to so many buildings in the capital just a few short years ago. This brings us, I guess, to the nub of the issue that you're going to have to confront, which is what is the weighting of risk of loss of life and or physical harm versus the cost of these buildings, and all buildings, in fact. And there are earthquake-prone building owners who've done their own analysis. Hazel Kirkham, I'm referencing, I'm sure she's written to you and others have. They've done their own analysis into how much current rules are costing versus potential loss of life. And their conclusion was that regardless of cost of retro-engineering or demolishing up to 20,000 buildings to save three from collapse, there would be something like 29 lives saved over a period of 75 years where the current settings stand. Now, we had correspondents from Christchurch immediately pointing out, and rightly so, that that's fatalities and that you need to factor in the enormous life-changing injuries and the scale of those injuries in a major earthquake. But as it stands, do you accept their analysis that is the value of life we are putting on this risk compared to road accidents or any other number of risks we put an economic value on?
I accept it's absolutely the kind of conversation that we need to have as part of the review. That work by Ms. Kirkham and others who have crunched the numbers, I haven't replicated, so I can't speak for the number of cents in the dollar that they've concluded is currently the case from a cost-benefit analysis point of view, but it's absolutely the right question to be asking. I mean, if nothing else, lest anyone should feel squeamish about the age-old debate of lives versus livelihoods, if nothing else, we could spend the same amount of money on building safety, perhaps in relation to fire systems, and maybe save more lives. And I don't know if that's the case or not, but that's the kind of thing we should be asking.
Who will do this particular analysis for you, Minister? Because this is a key one, and it's a very difficult one to discuss, especially with such a major earthquake in recent memory, and people will have very strong feelings about it. But who will do the analysis that says these are the lives that would be saved with the settings as they are?
Well, we've got some very smart people in this country. And by the way, there's some smart people overseas as well who do analysis of exactly this. And, you know, we're not the only seismically prone country in the world. So the good news is, you know, we'll have the ability to crunch those numbers and come up with something sensible. I think the real difficulty will actually be, or rather the challenge will be, from a political perspective, what appetite does the New Zealand public have for treating earthquake risk in just any other way, such as, you know, for example, road deaths, where for some reason we tend to accept a greater number per year appears to be somewhat inevitable. And of course, you know, no one would wish that to be the case. But the reality is, it is difficult for the human mind to comprehend something happening of a very small chance of happening, but with great consequences when it does. It might only be that we have one major earthquake every 100 years, but it might be that we have multiples of 100 people die in that event. And if we say, well, that's not very likely, or that the 200 people in that one building is fewer than the road toll deaths, that's not a very comfortable conversation for people to have. And yet, you know, from a public policy point of view, we do owe it to New Zealanders at least to be able to have that conversation and see where the appetite for risk is.
Do you have any appetite for the government itself being involved in this issue in the form of a fund or being able to oil the wheels fiscally for some kind of a change in the system here, whether it's councils lending, councils doing work on their own buildings, or whether it's trying to facilitate a third party to come in and take over some of these buildings and upgrade them? If the review comes out and says actually the settings should be similar or equivalent in terms of the number of buildings impacted, what's your next plan?
Well, good question. Ask me again in 4 years. No. Look, I mean, it's hard to know what such a scheme might look like. The amount of money are so vast that could be spent and are being spent in this area. So I probably should not speculate as to what any kind of government support might look like. I think the first duty of the government is to ensure that the settings are right such that people can themselves make such arrangements. And I'd certainly rather be recommending those kinds of decisions to government ministers than be talking about ways that one taxpayer can fund the upgrade of another's private property.
Okay, Chris Penk is the Minister for Building and Construction. You're listening to 9 to Noon with Catherine Ryan on RNZ National. Can we just talk quickly, please, before we let you go, on this business of the move last week also to loosen regulatory requirements or to change the system, really, to make it easier to bring in more imported building products, specifically to bypass application and testing requirements on individual products from trusted jurisdictions. What will determine what is a trusted jurisdiction, please?
Well, the technical answer is that will be determined and published in gazette notices, which is to say the government will be able to make those determinations based on expert technical advice as we go along. So we will be getting New Zealand's technical know-how and values involved in that judgment, but we'll be doing it at the whole jurisdiction or whole certification system level, rather than asking New Zealand experts to turn their mind to the question product by product, building consent authority by building consent authority, namely each individual council. And so that's the way that we will do it in a way that will reflect the reality of overseas jurisdictions.
Why not pick up what Rick Heard told us, former Naylor Love boss, because his point was that even some products that have been imported here from very trusted jurisdictions by any measure fail. And he also referenced, as did Paul Grimshaw, former Leakey Buildings, leader in the Leakey Buildings legal minefield, that weather conditions here might have a particular consideration to be taken into when you're talking about window flashings vis-a-vis Australia. Why not beef up a system here, simplify it so that it's not council by council, beef up a national testing and application check, or at least a second set of eyes check in New Zealand? Because there will be failures. And the problem then is, who do you follow up with? Who holds the consequences?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is, and I, by the way, I very much respect that opinion of Rick Heard and also Mr. Grimshaw. I understand the arguments, but I would also say it's the case already that we've got a couple of different systems for doing exactly that already. I've got a code mark system in New Zealand that someone can have a product, including from overseas, tested against that, and councils must take note of it. At the moment, it can take up to 2 years to get products.
Why? Certified. Why does it have to take so long?
Well, I simply don't know the answer to that, but I do know that it's a real thing, because we'll remember during the JIB plasterboard shortage of a couple of years ago, particularly urgent action was needed, I think, of a legislative nature in the end, to try and get around this problem. And it shouldn't be a problem in the first place. And the unseen cost of this isn't just, of course, in a particular case where a supply chain fails or domestic production fails. Actually, it's a general problem where we've got a huge cost of building in this country. And, you know, the effects on that in terms of housing supply and therefore homelessness can't be ignored any longer. Yeah. So we've got to be a bit bolder.
I mean, their point is just beef up the capacity here to do it properly. Streamline a testing or a requirement or an oversight here. But for goodness sake, beef it up. Because you know what happens when there are major failures of a product, the business goes bust, the builder goes bust or whatever and doesn't want to know about it. Everyone blames everyone else, and the homeowner is left, in the case of a major failure, with their retirement savings ruined. So it's a perspective worth thinking about, for sure. Yeah?
Yes, it is. And it's part of, though, a bigger picture question and discussion about where risk and liability lies. At the moment for councils, and one of the reasons they're risk averse, and as a ratepayer, I'm grateful that they are risk averse, is because they have joint and several liability, which is to say, in relation to building products, but also other parts of the building process, you have the possibility that the council will be 100% liable for any damage, defects, and effectively indemnifying a building owner against such difficulties because they're involved in consenting every step of the way. And without reference to bonds, guarantees, private insurance, and maybe a greater requirement that builders and others involved in the process need to be certified and registered. At the moment, that's not working particularly well either. Again, it makes people risk averse in an understandable way, but again, adding cost and delay, and we just can't afford that anymore.
Okay, if you go with the Australian Watermark, which is a jurisdiction and indeed a certification that I think was used in an example when you announced this policy, what will that mean for potential reform of existing regulations, for example, the Building Product Information Requirements, or BPIR, that only came into force last December? Will that stay or will that go?
Well, we're seeing how that system beds down because it is, as you say, very new. We've only had a few months worth of it. Potentially, there's a good tie-in, actually, between requirements put in place by the last government, but having come into effect in December, as you say, between a regime where we say, well, we're going to be a bit more liberal about, or rather more encouraging of products coming in from overseas. But then again, you also have to be more open and upfront about their origin. But then again, it might be that there are unintended consequences in terms of commercial sensitivities about, people doing research about good products overseas that meet higher or equivalent standards, and people import those, and they're incentivized to do that at the moment because there's a competitive advantage. So we're just trying to think about how these things all interact. It's tricky because you've got private markets involved and commercial imperatives, but at the same time, the protection of the Kiwi consumer. From a safety of building point of view, but also in terms of having it actually possible, physically and financially possible, for these damn things to get built, that we don't have people living on the streets anymore.
Thank you. Chris Pink is the Minister for Building and Construction.